Hey, welcome to a new episode of Skin in the Game. I'm your host, John Simperman, with my co-host,
Tim Elshai.
Tim, really great guests today. We have an organization, Soccer Without Borders, which is focused on something we talk a lot about here, increasing access, increasing accessibility to sport, and now celebrating its 20th anniversary. We have the executive director, Jennifer Tepper, and also the Boston director, Bruno Contreras, joining us on the program today.
You know, and Soccer Without Borders, John, is doing the work today under some of the toughest conditions imaginable.
Yes, they are.
And I mean, yeah, I mean, just to throw it right out there, and regardless of where people fall politically or what your views are on immigration and whether borders themselves should be
right.
open or closed, there are a lot of people here, a lot of kids here, who in this country, the United States, and in Canada too, who will benefit and do benefit from playing a game that they love, and in many cases, a game they grew up with. And Soccer Without Borders is making that possible.
Well, and it's everything we talk about with this, you know, the negative impact of the privatization of sports, right? The commercialization of sports, the pay-to-play model, which is putting, you know, boundaries and building walls on who can play, who can afford to play. You know, we're missing some of that grassroots, especially, you know, among underprivileged neighborhoods. And Soccer Without Borders is going into communities and, again, recruiting coaches, identifying soccer pitches, soccer fields, and finding a way to bring these kids together. Not necessarily so that they'll get their own name, image, and likeness deal, but that they'll build friendships and they'll feel part of a community. And at the end of the day, that's what youth sports is all about.
Yeah, it becomes a home for them. And something else with Soccer Without Borders that we're going to get into is the incredible job they're doing in recruiting, developing, training, and retaining coaches.
Right.
Right. And that's, you know, you talk about the thing that's like right in front of us when we think about youth sports, but so easy to either undervalue or brush off. You know, it's two things. One is great officiating, like officials who know the sport, love the sport, and communicate well with kids. But even perhaps even more so, it's coaches
right.
who know the sport, love the sport, and teach life through the sport. And
right.
Soccer Without Borders really has that mastered.
Well, and they do, and congrats to them. They are also the recipient of the Celebration of Service Award, which was awarded by Sports Business Journal. Big celebration on May 20th at Times Square. So not just us thinks they're doing a great job. They've been recognized nationally for the work they're doing.
Yeah,
so,
Sports Business Journal is the authority in the sports world. We've had Josh Barnett from Sports Business Journal on the
right.
program. And yeah, when SBJ picks up on what you're doing, you know you're doing something right, and they're doing something very right. So
yeah, so stay tuned for our interview with the leadership of Soccer Without Borders. But Tim, before we get to that, a couple of news things. Something which is a national, actually an international story, happened in our backyard. We demonstrated, or at least the Buffalo Sabres fans demonstrated, they all know every word of the Canadian national anthem. So it was great to see them kind of pick up the microphone when there was a technical malfunction at the arena.
Yeah, I mean, and to set the stage, the Buffalo Sabres are playing the Boston Bruins in the first round of the NHL playoffs. The Sabres official anthem singer, Cammy Clooney,
who I believe you was a former student of yours?
She was a student of mine.
Wow.
Yeah, I taught Cammy when she was in 9th grade and 10th grade, and we're still in touch. I'm incredibly impressed by her and proud of her. And even more impressed and more proud at what she's been able to, you know, not only what she's accomplished as a singer, but for the grace by which she handled this situation. So Cammy was starting to sing the Canadian National Anthem, which is the first of the two anthems that gets performed at every Sabres game.
Every Sabres game.
Every Sabres
yes.
game. Yeah, even if it's two, as it was this time, two American teams playing every Sabres game Canada plays. So Cammy started singing, and she was maybe a few words in, and you know her voice cut out. She looked at the mic, kept smiling, kept singing, but you couldn't hear her voice. And immediately, 19,000 people jumped in, and started singing the words.
Yeah.
And they carried it through all the way to the end, you know, and then Cammy was handed a new microphone for the Star Spangled Banner.
Right. Well, that was, you know, and it was great to see. I actually did, as that was happening, I sent a text message to the leadership of Visit Buffalo, who is obviously trying to attract the Canadian visitor back down into the Western New York region. I said, this is your new marketing campaign. You know, welcome back Canada to the U.S. So there's lots of issues out there that are bigger than what we can solve here on Skin in the Game, but it was nice to show how sport can bring people together and celebrate, in this case, you know, Canadian and U.S. culture.
Yeah, I mean, bringing two countries together at a time where that's, you know, that's been difficult to do. Now, you and I are American. I've been in Canada quite a bit lately. I'm sure you have over the last year or two. I notice no difference. People are, you know, they see the license plate. They're still incredibly welcoming, incredibly friendly. So sometimes, you know, the reality when you travel north or south of the border yourself, or when you get 19,000 hockey fans in an arena and the mic cuts out, you see what the tone between the two countries is really like, which is the closest of friends and allies.
Right, right. So that was great to see, and kudos to the fans of the Sabrehood for carrying on the anthem. The other quick news, switching sports to the National Football League. I'm not sure if you saw, but the Cleveland Browns.
Oh, I saw it, and I've been, keep going, but I've been waiting to ask you about this.
They have done the official groundbreaking of their $2.4 billion dome stadium in Brook Park, Ohio, which is about 10 miles north of the city, adjacent to the airport.
Basically Cleveland Airport area.
Cleveland, right. Literally, it's the neighbor of the airport, but not in downtown. So yes, $2.4 billion. And actually, the owners of the Cleveland Browns, the Haslam family, has pitched it as a future Super Bowl location.
With that dome. And so, John, here's the question I've been waiting to ask you. You are a Cleveland native. I know you love your hometown. But should it? Should Cleveland host the Super Bowl?
Well, it's not if it should. It's if it can. And according to the commissioner, Roger Goodell, he said, well, not so fast. And it really comes down to, you know, you need 50 to 60,000 hotel rooms to support a Super Bowl. Today, Cleveland has around 23,000 hotel rooms.
So really what you need to build is not a state. Well, you do need to build a stadium, but you need to build,
right?
What, double the number of hotels?
Right. Well, and
they got to be good hotels,
well,
too.
And that's why they talk about, you know, what could Buffalo, you know, support a Super Bowl and things of that sort. And, you know, it doesn't come down to having a dome or not a dome. It really comes down to, do you have the infrastructure, right?
Yeah.
So what's interesting is for a market like Cleveland, which has hosted the NFL draft, or a market like Buffalo that wants to host an NFL draft, that's probably a better fit based upon what you need as far as hotels and infrastructure.
Yeah, incredible infrastructure and capacity to not only move around guests, but house guests in hotels.
Yeah.
That's what gets you a Super Bowl, and not a lot of cities qualify.
No, not a lot. But you know what a roof does get you, and Cleveland should focus on, is Final Four.
Oh, absolutely. Cleveland. And that should, that's been, I saw Caitlin Clark playing the Final Four,
right?
You know, 2-3 years ago.
Yeah.
Incredible experience. So you're talking men's.
Men's
NCAA
and women's,
Final Four.
But also, you could obviously bring in concerts 12 months a year.
You can bring in Final Four.
You know, you take a look at what Indianapolis has done. They've become a sports mecca because of their dome.
Right.
So, yeah.
Plenty you can do.
Super Bowl, not so fast.
It's a nice thought, though.
Yeah. So with that, we want to bring on the leadership of Soccer Without Borders, Jennifer Tepper, the executive director, and Bruno Contreras, who is the program director for the fine state of Massachusetts. Hey, guys, thanks for joining us here on Skin in the Game.
Thanks, John. Thanks for having us.
Thank you so much.
Hey, Jennifer, maybe I'll start with you. I came across your organization, you know, in some of the work that we do here on Skin in the Game. I was really impressed with what you're doing and how you're trying to get, you know, make sport more accessible. But for our listeners, can you give us a little bit of the history and the mission of Soccer Without Borders?
Sure thing. Soccer Without Borders started 20 years ago in 2006. And since then, we've served over 60,000 youth hailing from over 122 countries, speaking over 112 different languages. And what we do is we see the connective language, the universal language that soccer is for so many youth and so many cultures and so many people, and bring people together, bring kids together, particularly immigrant, refugee, asylum-seeking youth, to form friendships and reach their inherent potential by using the sport of soccer. We have two other pillars outside of soccer, which is education and community cohesion. And by bringing these kids together with caring coaches, we have for 20 years been able to work with transforming the lives of 60,000 youth.
Which is wonderful. What important work. And Jennifer and Bruno, thank you for joining us. I'm going to ask you to both dive in a little bit deeper on that. So you're working with kids who oftentimes are new to this country, whose families are going through a lot of challenges and probably more today than we've seen ever, right? What is it? So what does it look like? Like, how do you get the kids involved? What do you need to do for the kids and for their families to, you know, for the families and the children themselves to know that they're safe and well taken care of? How do you make it all work?
It's a great question. I'm going to start on some kind of higher level pieces and then that kind of our best practices across all of our locations. And Bruno can get into some of the explicit details that he sees every day in our Massachusetts office and with the kids we work with in Massachusetts. So a lot of this is about building trust. I mean, it almost all inherently comes down to building trust. And we have a real commitment to working with what we call coach mentors or, you know, practitioners, because we see our coaches not just as experts in soccer, but experts in building relationships with adolescent youth. Most of our kids are in that middle school to high school age. And you're absolutely right, Tim. They don't speak English very well. They're new to the country. They're new to the systems. They're figuring out how to make friends. They have tons of various priorities, including, you know, figuring out if they should be working a job maybe instead, to figure out how to make it in their new communities. And our coaches in all of our locations really work with schools, work with service providers that are helping integrate these community members into these various locations and build lasting and trusted relationships with them. And it often starts by the activity of soccer, because everybody seems to really get what that is, no matter what language you speak. And so at a very high level, that is what we do. And we're pretty, for 20 years, we've become real experts at inclusive coaching. Again, not the technical aspects of the sport, but what it means for kids to love coming to a Soccer Without Borders practice. And it's inside of that practice that all of those connections are made, and the other aspects of education, service provision, and ensuring that the mental, behavioral health and wellness of our youth are really tackled. And Bruno can go into how what that looks like.
Of course, yeah. So I think we have a unique framework. We call it like family framework. And it's like specifically like on the field, like the coaches have different like targets, different behaviors that to create the most inclusive, fun, equitable experience for our participants. So like small details, like each coach, they know that they have to high five every kid that comes to our field. They're checking in like how was school. We have our opening and closing circle to check in, to debrief. And we have like the team building activities to make like one-on-one connections, because this is all about building trust and making connections. And with newcomer youth, that's what we want. Like when we move to a new country, that's my story as well. You always ask like, how can I contribute? How can I learn? And can I find my place here? So those questions, we bring it to our field, and we try to make that space for the kids to make those connections and learn the game, but also learn about others.
Bruno, what's the age of most of these kids that are getting involved with the programs?
Well, we like here in Massachusetts, we serve like around 1,200 youth. It's from 6 to 20 years old. But I would say like the middle school and high school are like the ages that we try to focus on. We see that those ages tend to find like more barriers for like to participate in more like an organized sport. Is where like they try to find their identity, and there's is when the statistics say like they drop, like they stop playing sports. So we try to focus like all our efforts on those ages, like the middle school and the high school.
Tell me more about where you find the coaches and how you train them, because I got to tell you both, I'm sitting here, you know, Bruno, listening to what the coaches are doing and high-fiving every kid and asking them about school and building those one-to-one connection. And, you know, John, I'm thinking this is what we want every coach out there doing. We've talked about that a lot here.
In every sport.
In every sport. So, yeah, well, tell us about your coaching pipeline.
Mm-hmm. One part of our design is, like, we want coaches to represent the kids that we were serving. So like the 82% of our full-time coaches are from different like cultural backgrounds. All of our coaches speak, they are bilingual. That's like something that we're very intentional about. Like, because we're not against, like any person can be like a coach regardless of the background. But when you have that cultural connection with the kid, it completely breaks down like a lot of barriers. The way that you connect with the families, especially like working with girls of color, there's a lot of like cultural barriers that when a coach from the countries that of our participants, when we have that dialogue, it's from a different approach, different like power dynamic even. Mm-hmm. So that's one. How do we recruit them? That's a little bit of an art and science, you know? Like we want people from the communities. So yeah. In order to recruit them, you need to be there. Like you need to go to the fields. You need to talk to that person that like volunteers once with you, and you see that dynamic person and that represent that our culture. So you connect with them, and that's how we like all our 10 coaches in Massachusetts is that's how we recruit them. And also a lot is like our alumni. We're investing a lot in like a youth pipeline from youth participant to coach.
Yeah,
absolutely. And just to add on to that a little bit, Tim and John, I mean, one of the biggest differences, and I can tell you firsthand, it's not easy to maintain, but we have just around 100 full-time and part-time staff members. And almost all of our coaches are full-time salaried, benefited individuals. And when you think about youth sports, and you even think about some of the most elite teams growing up, youth in any sport, many of the coaches are stipended. They're doing it outside of their full-time jobs. And for us, our mission is dependent on having folks who are invested in every single aspect of not just coaching the sport, but learning new things like, you know, how do I work with a group of girls or boys in my on my team who maybe just had two friends deported? Okay. And so if that happens, what are our coaches thinking about? What kind of mental health, behavioral health resources are we tying into our time with our youth? How are we reaching out and talking to other adults in those youth's lives to create a supportive, loving, trusted environment, you know? And you know, so these are the things that we really invest in. And it makes our business model a little bit different than a lot of the organizations out there doing youth sports. And I'm not saying that it's easy to get here. I'm just saying that it requires a lot of investment, and it requires a lot of, we have the generosity of a lot of individuals, institutions, and companies that help make this happen.
I just, you know, Jennifer, I wanted to ask you that, and you kind of led me right into it.
Oh, sorry.
No, thank you, because it was a good bridge right in to a question about funding. Yeah, I mean, 100 full and part-time staff members, full-time coaches, that's amazing. And expensive, I'm sure. So, talk a little bit more about what does it take to fund this? What kind of individuals, what kind of corporations and grants are you looking for? And I'm going to throw one other question in there too, on an already complicated topic. What's the current climate for getting funding for this too? Is it particularly challenging nowadays?
Yeah, absolutely. I don't think, I guess I would just say that nonprofit fundraising is probably, most nonprofit leaders would probably agree that is challenging always. And I'm not trying to, you know, over generalize or minimize the question, but I think it is because we're always seen kind of as a nice to have, not necessarily where government services and or, you know, workforce and employability or, you know, education and healthcare kind of need to haves. You know, the work of nonprofits can sometimes be put to the side as kind of a nice to have and harder to get revenue for. Our organization is a mix of primarily government and philanthropic funding. And when I say government, it's actually not very much at the federal level. It's a lot of pass-throughs, local school districts, you know, sometimes refugee resettlement funds that are at the state level that come in because they see us as a unique organization that provides services for a subset of the population in their communities that many service providers don't have the ability to work with in a genuine and effective manner. So those are a lot of our government sources. We've really benefited also from a variety of what I would call local, regional philanthropic institutions. So not as much the national ones, because we're an international organization, but made up of really amazing pockets of work at the community level. So a lot of our institutional funders philanthropically are kind of invested in, say, Oakland or San Francisco or Denver, you know, the areas where we serve, Boston, like Bruno works in. So I think that's a huge part of it. We are trying to grow our individual giving. That is an area that we know we do get a lot of investment from, but we are trying to grow that. It's one of our smallest pockets of revenue. And you know, all of that kind of add up to about $6.4 million a year, of which almost all of it go to our people, because our people is what makes our services work. You know, so we don't really have any, let's say, unrestricted funds to do much more than invest in our people, our services, and our youth, you know. So that's what it goes to do. Is the climate harder? The climate's changed. It's definitely harder in the sense that we've expenses that were unexpected. So, for example, as this administration has worked hard to determine who is in this country in a documented fashion, that has kind of politicized a lot of DEI efforts from all over. Well, DEI is politicized, sorry. But for corporates who had maybe DEI efforts, it's really politicized their ability to invest in their communities more holistically. And so a lot of this has been adaptability. We've worked really hard in the last couple years from the beginning of 2025. So, geez, only 15 months now. But
feels
longer, really adapt.
I'm guessing.
Yeah. Yeah. Last 15 months, I'm doing two major things, really digging into the core of what we do, not necessarily who we serve, and focusing on the what that we're doing, which actually has benefits much further, reaching much further than who we serve currently, but also really focusing in on keeping the data and the information and our youth feeling safe and protected in the communities that they're working, you know, while they work with us. It's a time where a lot of folks that we work with just don't feel very safe. And so we want to be that place that people feel safe in.
Yeah, yeah. Important work, important times. I'm with Jennifer Tepper and Bruno Contreras from Soccer Without Borders. Hey, Jennifer or Bruno, either you can or both can take this. You know, Tim and I have had conversations over the last year here on Skin in the Game, we've spoken to the Aspen Institute. We've spoken to regional and national folks around Project Play. And it just seems that with, you know, club teams and house leagues going away in all sports, and in a lot of the more urban areas, a lot of the extracurriculars, i.e. sports, are also being eliminated. It really seems like your program, Soccer Without Borders, has helped filling some of those holes. Am I correct in that statement?
Absolutely. And I'm going to actually let Bruno kick this one off. He has a great story about one of our youth named Julian, who might really kind of exemplify this right. question.
Yeah, of course. I have a story. It's about Julian. I used to coach, just to be more on the field, not anymore. I miss that those times. But I remember a few years ago, I was walking through a park in East Boston, and I saw a group of middle school kids just kicking a ball around. And I stopped, introduced myself. I invited them to join our program. And the next day, they all show up, and they that whole group grew up together with us. And I still remember that their first year, they got into a fight during one of our league games, and they were. I mean, like they were young. They were still figuring out things out. They just arrived to the country, and one of those players was Julian, a Colombian kid, and from early on, like you could tell he had something special, like left-footed defender, really skilled, natural leader. At one point, he expressed interest to go to the next level. So we usually do that, like when we see someone like expressing interest to find other places, we help them and we connect him with to an academy to continue developing. Last year, I went to a high school playoff game, and I saw him again back with our team, and I asked him about his experience at the academy, and he told me like my family couldn't keep up with the cost. I had an hour commute each way. And honestly, the environment, it was just a lot of stress and coaches yelling all the time. And I didn't feel like myself anymore. So I'm here, I'm back. I can just play and enjoy the game again with Coach Ronnie. Shout out to Coach Ronnie. Mm-hmm. That really stayed with me. And what's even more powerful is that the same group of kids, like including Julian, the ones who got into that fight years ago, like by the end of that season, earned the sportsmanship award in the tournament. So you see this full circle moment, and that's really what we're trying to create, like those spaces, those where young people can develop, like and feel supported and actually enjoy being part of the game, and also connected to what you mentioned about like this gap. I have another example. You have that time to share about a league, like a community league. It's called Liga de Paz, League of Peace, and it's a weekly league that brings together newcomer youth from across our different Soccer Without Borders sites in the greater Boston area. And it actually started in response to a challenge we ran into when trying to participate in more traditional town travel league. And as we've expanded into new communities through our after-school programs, we were entering teams into that league. And over time, we realized we were running up against something deeper, and we noticed how territorial youth soccer can be in Massachusetts, maybe not only in Massachusetts. There's this underlying mindset that kids belong to the town club they live in. And from a competition standup, there was concern that we were there to pull away their strongest players. And we tried to work within that system, and we had conversations with local clubs about placing our players there, even asking about scholarships. And while there was openness, it often came with limits, and opportunities tended to be available for the most skilled player. Like they were saying, like, yeah, I only have five scholarships, but not for everyone. So yeah, so we made the decision to stop participating in that league and instead creating Liga de Paz, like something designed intentionally to be inclusive and accessible to everyone, regardless of skill level. For those young people, like, soccer is more than a game. It's like a process to a way to process transition and uncertainty. So yeah, like the structure reflects that, like the structure that we provide reflects that, like we provide the transportation, so getting there isn't a barrier. We offer snacks and uniforms, so families don't have to worry about cost. Our high school youth leaders serve as referees, which create leadership pathways within the program.
And Bruno, are you working with local towns, local school districts, as far as accessing your pitches?
Yeah, like parks and recreation of like each town. Like we serve in Boston, in Chelsea, Somerville. So we have like good relationship with all the departments of the especially like parks and recreation.
Mm-hmm. I really appreciate hearing both of you talk about the incredible impact that Soccer Without Borders has on these kids, and that the game of soccer, the sport of soccer, has on these young people as well. I am curious how often you hear from these kids about the journey they took to get to where they are. You know, I know I was a longtime newspaper journalist, and I wrote a lot about refugees and asylees and asylum seekers. And the common thread was that their path to get here is far more arduous than people could possibly realize. And a lot of times they were reluctant to talk about it, but that was me as a newspaper reporter, which is a completely different thing than a coach, which is one of the closest relationships you can have. So I could see what you're doing, opening up a dialogue where there could be a release and cathartic. And I'm wondering how often that happens and what that looks like.
We actually work in partnership with a lot of other organizations that have programming that does avail for those opportunities, where coaches are trained in evidence-based methods to do that. So in a way that our coaches do have an awareness that what they're doing isn't necessarily bringing on more harm or re-traumatizing or having kids go through any sort of PTSD type, you know, impact. We work with kids who are unaccompanied minors, or they've come here with the expectation of being the primary driver of economic wealth in their family. And, you know, both Bruno and I are first generation immigrants ourselves, you know, and for me, it was really hard, probably relevant to some of the stories Bruno was already told. It was really hard to get my parents to even allow me to find space to play. It was so culturally not acceptable, you know, to really kind of do that. So a lot of those kind of get mixed in with the stories. Some of the programs that we do hold is a program in partnership with Futures Without Violence. They're based in DC, but they do a lot of work internationally as well. And it's called Coaching Boys into Men. And so it's really a facilitated training project where we work with boys to explore kind of often in our closing circles, like kind of after some play, sitting down, you know, and having that space to talk about everything from how has masculinity presented itself. I mean, okay, I'm using much more academic words than our coaches would, but you know, how has masculinity kind of presented itself in your lifetime? You know, what have the impacts been around everything from whether or not your father's been in the picture or not? You know, what are certain peer pressure, bullying kind of dialogues that you feel like you're part of? So those kind of conversations get surfaced, you know, in some of our intentional programming with our youth, with some of the girls, depending on kind of location and really kind of the needs of our youth populations. We're very much driven by what we're seeing with the youth that we're working with and their voice and what they want to see for their programming. So we don't really have a cookie cutter model, but we have also partnered with No Means No Worldwide, which also provides a lot of similar vehicles of training for girls. You know, the way that coaching boys into men is really for boys and young men. So we do bring those into some of our enrichment activities. And then we also, like, we just recently in our Oakland site got, our Bay Area site, excuse me, got a very large grant, at least to us, to bring in an outdoor education component with our youth, because these youth are often not camping or exploring what, you know, opportunities are to have that kind of outdoor education experience. And I don't think we have any vehicle by which we're documenting what was said around the campfire, but I will bet with the coaches, a lot does get shared in those moments.
I'm with Jennifer Tepper and Bruno Contreras from Soccer Without Borders. Jennifer, you brought up coaching boys and men. Tim, I'm looking to you. I believe that was also the core of how this youth group, hockey group in Hamilton, to try to change the culture of their program, they also dove into the coaching boys into men just to try to make better people, right? And by the way, you'll be happy to know, Jennifer and Bruno, it also made them better hockey players and a better hockey team. So high five to both of you for weaving that into the program. And it is all about teaching the life skills, right? And that's really the core of it. So what's next for Soccer Without Borders? Where does the program evolve to? You know, you mentioned the outdoor element in the Bay Area, which is awesome. What else is on the horizon?
Well, it's our 20th anniversary, and we actually just launched our next four-year strategic plan, which is taking us from 26 to 30. As we kind of reflected on a little bit here, we know that we wouldn't be able to do everything we do if it wasn't for inclusive coaching. And so we've kept that internal, not intentionally. That's just organically what's kind of happened. And so we're hoping to explore how to, you know, work with more organizations in that way. And not only, it's really hard. It's like the brick and mortar expenses of putting together a Soccer Without Borders location is, I don't want to say it's cost prohibitive, but we are really committed to creating a model that's sustainable. Sure. We don't want kids to come to our program one season and the next season it's not there anymore because we hadn't figured out, you know, sustainable funding sources for that to be there. And so as a result, we're really committed to the four locations in the United States right now. And if there are funders listening and want us to come to Buffalo, we would love to come to Buffalo and get that started. But we are hoping to do a lot more in the inclusive coaching space and to increase opportunities for access to play, a lot of free leagues, free play. As we all know, play is essential for neuroscience development. And just the words pay to play means that there are kids that will not have as much access to neurological development, social emotional learning development that is so essential for when, you know, when kids are growing up. I mean, there's a reason why we all grew up with moms yelling us to go outside and play. You know, these are all super, super important things. And so we want to make sure that that ecosystem is still available, you know, so pay to play can continue. Like, there's no, you know, way we're going to stop it. But we really do hope that we remain a very strong alternative and help others, if they want to create that space, to have that as a strong alternative so that all kids can access play during the formative years of their lives.
Yeah. And Jennifer, just for our listeners, just what are those four major hubs, markets that you're currently have the programming?
Absolutely. Baltimore, Maryland, Boston and surrounding cities, you know, but I don't know, Framingham's not really surrounding anymore. Framingham kind of goes out a little bit. And we're in Denver, Aurora, and also a town called Greeley, Colorado, which is about an hour and a half from Denver.
Yeah.
And then we're in San Francisco and Oakland.
Anything up north to our friends north of the border?
Nothing in Canada. We have really amazing, strong group of women that work with girls in Granada, Nicaragua. And we have a huge, very, very effective hub in Kampala, Uganda, working refugee leaders, working with refugee youth. It's really exciting.
Yeah, the work you're doing is so incredible. Bruno, I want to go back to John's question about what's next and ask you, what do you hope is next for Soccer Without Borders?
Yeah, I think like we're also like expanding our portfolio of services. Like it's not only like our team year-round program, right? Like our after school, like we're exploring like how to create like more inclusive leagues, clinics, tournaments. Like how can we support other organizations in Massachusetts and in New England that are like super passionate to serve immigrant and underserved girls, and like if we can bring those resources and support them to make a bigger impact. Like I think I see that as a next step too.
I will add one quick thing. We're also really we've been working with youth leaders and employability issues and workforce, what I wouldn't say development, but readiness, kind of getting youth ready for the workforce. And we've been doing that also, I think, documented since 2011. And within our own internal organization, we actually just put together 55 competencies that we even evaluate our own staff on and connect that into everything from the administrative side of the work to what it takes to be a coach and what it takes to be a ref and what it takes to be a youth leader. And so we're really hoping to broaden that as well and broaden, I mean, especially as the world of professional sports is growing so much, you know, there has to be opportunities for our youth to connect in, especially as they've grown up in a sporting kind of environment.
Right.
And I just want to say, I'd love to go to Toronto. I love Toronto.
we do too.
We'd recommend it.
Well, and you talk about such a strong soccer hub. Obviously, it's going to even grow with the World Cup this summer. But yeah, multicultural, international. I mean, it is, you know, Hamilton, Toronto are big, big soccer markets. You brought up pro sports. Just wanted to just... Have you have any partnership, affiliation, i.e. internships, financial support from any of the professional teams in these markets?
Yeah, so it's interesting. We have so our Baltimore hub is really connected in with the Washington Spirit, mm-hmm. you know, and the NWSL there. So is our Bay Area girls. They do a lot with Bay FC. And so everything from campaigns that are either donation or jersey sales, you know, merch related, mm-hmm. girls are designing it. So a lot of programming related. But also we have already been working with Chicago Fire and the MLS, as well as St. Louis SC, where we've been brought in as coach educators, you know, contracted coach educators to work with their development team squads, their coaches or their community coaches that are really expanding their soccer access to kids all throughout, say, St. Louis and Chicago. We've also worked with the USL teams in Detroit and Oakland Roots and Seoul, also in this manner around inclusive coaching education. And, you know, like Toronto, I know you guys know Justin Morrow, former player in Toronto, and we work with him and a coalition of other organizations that are kind of more in the spirit of ensuring that access and community is still at the heart, at more of a kind of an advocacy, education, knowledge level, is community still at the heart of all of this soccer and World Cup headlines that we're going to be getting, right. you know, now through the end of July, and making sure that communities of all colors, all ethnicities, all languages are able to have a really great time with the sport in the coming months.
That's great. Well, Jennifer, Bruno, I want to thank you for joining us on Skin in the Game. And I also want to thank you for doing the great work you're doing with Soccer Without Borders. So we look forward to staying in touch and have a great soccer season as the World Cup comes to North America.
Thank you, John. Thank you, Tim, for the time.
You got it. Yeah, Bruno, Jennifer, thank you.
Again, I want to thank Jennifer Tepper and Bruno Contreras from Soccer Without Borders. Great conversation, important topic. And Tim, I'm really, really glad we had him on the show.
Me too. And man, John, I mean, that just listed out what a good coach should be.
Right.
Right. And I was writing this down because I want to remember it. High-fiving every kid, asking him, how was school? Having that opening and closing circle, the building the one-to-one connection, bearing in mind all these kids are trying to find a place, not only on a team, but in a country,
right?
And I mean, soccer, and especially incredible coaching, is such a powerful way to make that happen.
Yeah. I mean, we've had on our program, you know, a number of guests. I remember going back a year or so, Bridget Nyland talked a lot about project play and teaching life skills. And again, a lot of these attributes around good coaching, you know. And I think what really I want to emphasize here, and this is why I wanted to get Soccer Without Borders on our program, is we've had a lot of conversation about the negative effects of the privatization, the commercialization of youth sports. House leagues are being eliminated. Yeah. After school programs are being eliminated. There's nowhere for these kids to go. Programs like Soccer Without Borders, and also even here regionally, Project Play, they do provide that place where kids can go, make friends, assimilate, and, you know, share a passion. In this case, a passion is soccer.
I was glad you asked the question about what's next and how do you grow this, because it is expensive. Obviously, you know, full-time coaches for a youth sports organization, that's amazing.
And providing transportation.
And transportation.
It's always been the gap. You know, you can find a pitch, you can find a field, you know, you can find some volunteer coaches, but getting the kids to the pitch, or in this case, you know, to the field, it can be difficult.
And in this case, too, there's security costs. You know, Jennifer mentioned they even just keeping the data safe, right? And that has everything to do with this political climate, this law enforcement climate that we're in. If you're an organization like Soccer Without Borders, you are thinking of safety far beyond getting hurt or not on a field, or being coached well or not, as important as that is in a game. These are people who are coming to this country or in this country and want to stay. And you play a role in that happening, right? Yeah. And so the work they're doing is incredibly complicated, incredibly valuable, and yeah, pricey to expand too.
Yeah, so. Well, but it just seems they would rather go deep into a market rather than try to dilute and spread out their resources.
That was very cool to hear about, like, you know, the outdoor education, you know, going beyond the game of soccer, going beyond that soccer field.
Right. Well, 60,000 youth they have, you know, engaged with in their 20-year history. It's hard to quantify, and maybe our guest Bruno, you know, could enlighten us, but how many kids of those 60,000 did they help? And I don't want to go as heavy as say how many of those kids did they save, but how many of those kids did they help feel comfortable and ultimately, now 20 years later, be productive, contributing, comfortable citizens, right?
Yeah, and I mean, how do you quantify it? Yeah, that's
right.
That's a great question. I can tell you this, though. Talking with Bruno and Jennifer made me think back to an experience I had about 5 or 6 years ago that really punctuated the importance of sports to youth in these situations, mm-hmm. youth who are coming to this country, and maybe even particular the game of soccer. I will tell you the story. The first line will make you laugh, but I went with a group of nuns. Me, I was
okay.
The only one
this
who
was going to be. This is going to be interesting.
This will be. It was me and a group of sisters who were incredible people and good dinner and drinks people there too, by the way. But I went with a group of sisters down to San Antonio, Texas, where they were volunteering, and I was joining them to volunteer in a shelter for, in this case, adolescent boys who were 12 or 13 up through 17, who had come over the border into, in this case, obviously Texas, mm-hmm. either unaccompanied or they were split from their parents at the border, who were all waiting for, one by one, for a ticket to somewhere else in the United States, right? And we were inside a massive rodeo arena in San Antonio, and there were just rows and rows and rows of, you know, hundreds, really over 1,000 cots. And so, you know, just imagine all these boys, lines of cots, most of them were Catholic, so they enjoyed saying rosaries and doing prayers and learning a little bit of English. The sisters who were bilingual were doing that. The one thing that absolutely though made every kid smile was when somebody would bust out a soccer ball and all of a sudden these kids would pop off their cots and they would turn this rodeo arena, which didn't have a lot of open space, into a soccer field.
You
had to turn your head every way, you know, to avoid getting nailed in the head with a soccer ball. Yeah. But everywhere you looked, you saw these boys laughing and smiling. And these were kids who went through absolute hell to get here.
Yeah.
In worse, you know, far worse stuff than we even have time to go into here. These kids had gone through hell. Soccer is what made them smile.
Yeah, yeah, it was that icebreaker. You know, it get everybody comfortable. A common and a shared passion. And I think that's a lot of what we heard from Jennifer and Bruno, what they're doing, on a bigger level in Boston, Bay Area, also out in Colorado as well. I would encourage any of our listeners who do want to learn more about this program, or maybe even pitch Jennifer to bring the program to their market. Again, it's Soccer Without Borders, and you know, they go much deeper into what they're doing, where they're doing it, and how they can, you know, affect change positively.
Yeah, and I think a great growth opportunity for the organization, and Jennifer, you know, kind of previewed this, is taking that inclusive coaching that they absolutely have, you know, mastered, and helping share that with other sports organizations. Yeah. Good coaching is good coaching at every level, for every sport, in every configuration. And the tenets of inclusive coaching really are the tenets of great coaching, right? You and I both know, and we've heard this a lot, we've heard this from people in youth sports, we need to do more to support, to find and retain great coaches, and also to build great coaches, right? So Soccer Without Borders may be in a great position to play an important role in doing that.
Yeah. As we wrap up here, it was also good to hear some of the professional leagues in these markets and beyond these markets are helping contribute to the programs, because A, it's the right thing to do. That's the most important thing. But also for them, it is also helping at a grassroots level. We talk a lot about grassroots marketing, helping them build their next generation of fans. So you see this with flag football, you see this with Goals and Dreams with the NHL, and it's nice to hear that the MLS and the other professional leagues are also contributing and supporting these programs.
Well, it's where the right thing to do and the philanthropic thing to do can also actually be great marketing, right?
Like
sometimes they're not
mutually exclusive.
They're not. Let me go down this rabbit hole with you just slightly, because you know, you're a longtime sports marketing guy. You've run it for four big league teams. Did you often find that people thought marketing was like purely capitalistic, not bad thing, but kind of self-serving thing that didn't necessarily relate to doing the right thing for the community, that those were, you know, community relations and marketing were two entirely separate things?
Good question. And I think I was fortunate enough with the organizations I worked with, marketing and fan development and community relations all reported into my department. So you could always find a common thread and weave a common thread, and, you know, hopefully check boxes on, yes, you need to drive revenue, but with that revenue, can you also support some other things? So there are ways to do good and to do it right.
Yeah, and we see this. I think if you're a sponsor and, you know, some of your sponsorship dollars can go to helping the community, doing something really good for the fans, and especially the fans who could need it and use it the most, that's got to be gratifying.
Right.
Well, this has been great. John, you found Soccer Without Borders and brought them into the show. Thank you for doing
that. Yeah, no, glad we did. And again, Jennifer Tepper, Bruno Contreras from Soccer Without Borders, really appreciate them being on here. And also appreciate you tuning in. I'm John Simperman.
I'm Tim Alshai.
We'll see everybody next week. Skin in the Game is a production of Buffalo Toronto Public Media. You can catch up with all past episodes on btpm.org or on the Buffalo Toronto Public Media YouTube channel. Thanks for listening.